Welcome to this week's edition of Everything Fast Pitch. Coach Don and I are here getting ready to record the New Year's special.
Sweet.
Hard to believe that 2020 is almost over. Thank
goodness.
God.
Yeah.
All right. So episode number 144, we got a good show lined up for you today. In our warm-up segment, we've got our city of the week, our equipment tip of the week, another exciting did you know, a great listener question, and of course, Paige's power play. Our leadoff topic is our New Year's resolution and trying to work with and help players understand that there's potentially a loss of passion and seems like kids quitting the game at an alarming rate. And we want to talk about that a little bit. In our cleanup topic, we're going to talk about something a little bit more technical. It's helping defenses understand how to cover bases well on steals and what players should be doing and when they should be doing it. And then our coaching tip of the week revolves around the quality at bat, that a quality at bat is not always a hit. And so it's going to be a fun topic, a list of topics, some fun show as we get ready for the new year. So this one drops on December 30th, so right before the holiday. Don, you got any big New Year's plans?
No, just looking forward to a little bit of downtime and get to relax and enjoy family and friends. Yeah.
Good deal. So let's talk about Cleat It Up. Cleat It Up FP is the communications app that you need to be using. It's the tool that will solve all your communication challenges within your team or organization. Go to their website at cleatitup.com and check it out. Great tool, something that we strongly recommend, something that you'll really enjoy. Also want to talk about patreon.com/everythingfastpitch. Coach Don and I have been asking you as our listeners to come on board and support us. We really do appreciate the support of the people that have been doing that for us. And we want to go through the list really quickly as kind of our end of the year wrap up. So we want to say thank you to Adam Durston, Rob Rausch, Johnny Barnett, Billy Cooper, Christopher Kern, Andre Foster, Chad Lowe, Don Watson, Rob Jahanos,
Ron Bittinger,
John Davis, Chris Treptow, Sean Faust, Zachary Morse, Shane Merrill, Brian Corris, DJ Conroy, Jack Ingram, Jesse Hyatt. So thank you all very much for coming on board and being patrons.
We appreciate
it. We really
y'all.
Do appreciate it.
Yeah.
The one I've messed up is I don't have his last name and I can't find it. So anyhow, so we'll have to sub that one back in. 3, 2, 1. All right. So thank you to our patrons. If you're in a position where you can support us financially, Coach Don and I would really appreciate it. I promise we're not getting rich doing the podcast, but we've got a lot of expenses, a lot of things that we need help with. And our goal is to keep Everything Fast Pitch and Coach Prep a free service. We don't want to have to become a subscription deal. We don't want to be a paywall kind of thing. And the fact that so many of you are on board helping us as patrons is really appreciated and helpful. If you're in a position where you can help us, it would be great. Go to patreon.com/everythingfastpitch, and it's all going to get explained to you there. Our warm-up topic, Don, is brought to us by Nexair. Nexair is a Memphis-based industrial gas, medical gas, research gas, welding supply, and safety PPE supplier. With strategically placed retail locations, sales branches, and distribution centers throughout the Southeast, Nexair is never too far away. They maintain centralized product warehouses to serve you better and be more reliable. Through our services, you can receive the products you need when you need them. Our fleet of trucks will get you the gas you need when you need it. If you're interested in any Nexair product or service, or just want to talk through your options, please get in touch. Our customer care team at 888-639-2474 will help you find the branch or outside sales rep in your area. Please reach out to Nexair. They'll take care of all your needs. All right, Don, our city of the week, Decatur, Alabama.
Nice. We got Alabama's right next door.
Yep, and another big softball area.
For sure.
As we're always asking our listeners, please spread the word. Tell your friends that you know our Fast Pitch folks to listen to Everything Fast Pitch. I'm sure once they listen that they'll get hooked. Our numbers continue to grow. And every time we see a big jump in a city, we know it's because somebody is helping us and doing that for us. If everybody who listens can get one more person or two more people to listen, obviously that makes a big difference for us, for our numbers. And the podcast world is a numbers-driven business, so the more people that listen, the better off we are, and the more we can continue to do. So thank you to Decatur, Alabama. You are our city of the week.
And Tori, if they're new to us, you got to go back and listen to previous podcasts. There's tons of information,
so,
a lot of good stuff.
143 in the can, working
goodness,
on number 144.
Yeah.
But I will caution you, if you go back to the very beginning, it's rough.
Well, just start working your way back until it
feels rough. Yeah. So at some point in time, we started to figure some stuff out, but it wasn't the very first couple of episodes, that's for sure. We are again pausing on the player of the week. We're going to start again next week. So if you've got a recommendation, somebody that you would like to nominate, please reach out to us at fastpitchprep@gmail.com or everythingfastpitch@gmail.com. Send us the names and particulars of the player that you would like to nominate. Again, if it's something on the field, that's great. If it's something in the classroom, that's awesome. Something in the community, that's amazing. Anything that these kids are doing that is worthy of recognition, we want to recognize them as being the Fast Pitch Prep Player of the Week. And so please send us those nominations. Our equipment tip of the week, Don. We were hoping to have the Square Cuts training disc in people's hands for the new year.
It will be soon.
It's soon. I know we keep saying soon. We've been saying soon for a while. Corona has messed up our plan. We thought it was going to be 6 or 8 weeks when we started. Now it's 6 or 8 months, and we're still waiting. But once we get our hands on them, we're going to be doing some promotions. We're going to be doing some specials for our listeners. And again, we've gotten nothing but positive feedback. We've got a bunch of people using them now, the prototypes that we had originally. The feedback has just been 100% positive. I'm super excited that we've come up with something that people are really excited about and really interested in. One of the things that has surprised me is that, you know, we designed it to be a hitting tool, but people are figuring out ways to use it for pitching, for throwing. Even had somebody show me a bunting drill that they've created using the disc. So I think it's really cool that people are out there experimenting with it and finding other ways to use it. And it's something that we're really excited about and certainly happy to be bringing to market. So the Square Cuts training disc is the Fast Pitch Prep product. It's the first one that we've created and one I think we're going to really be excited to get in your hands as soon as possible. So, Don, did you know another one of those Division I records that appear to be unbreakable? You know, we've talked about it here for 3 or 4 weeks in a row. I keep looking at the record book thinking about how there's some things that have happened in the history of Division I softball, some things that have changed because of the number of games that players are now allowed to play that just make it really unlikely that some of these records are going to be broken. And the one I wanted to talk about today is from 1995. Laura Espinoza, Arizona great.
Absolutely, yeah.
Had 128 RBI in one season.
128 RBIs. How many? That's a lot of at-bats, too.
Yep, that's a pretty productive year.
A lot of at-bats.
So now she played 72 games. That's still a few more games than I think you're going to see anybody playing now, because the new rule is 56 is the number that you're allowed to play in the regular season. And you figure if you make it all the way to the College World Series, you might play another 12-ish.
So you're thinking 68-ish.
Yeah. I had the good fortune of seeing Laura Espinoza, and she was an amazing hitter, hit a lot of home runs, but was one of those people that when she hit the ball, it scared me to think that somebody was going to put a glove in front of it to try to catch it.
You can tell by the sound even.
Yeah. Well, and they had this thing, I don't know if you saw it on Facebook a couple of weeks ago, where somebody had done this experiment with basically a cannon and a baseball, and they were using ballistics dummy. And the ball goes through the ballistics dummy like it's a bullet. I mean, it just, you know, but they're doing it in super slow motion so you can see the ball like basically cutting through. And then they did another one where they lined up like 10 or 12 gloves in a row and the ball's just tearing through the leather glove like, you know, like there's nothing. You know, like it's just like a missile going through there. That's kind of the feeling I always had watching Espinoza hit. When she hit it good, that ball was seriously a rocket.
Nice.
So the record that we wanted to talk about this week is 128 RBIs in one season for Laura Espinoza. It's another one of those that I've got on the list of records that I don't think is ever going to be broken.
That's got to make her smile when she looks at that. That's great.
Absolutely. So our listener question this week comes to us from Kelly. Kelly's daughter is struggling to hit the ball consistently hard. She never strikes out. She always puts the ball in play, but she has a difficult time even hitting the ball out of the dirt and getting it on the grass.
Well, Tori, does it tell us how old she is?
It does not, but my guess is probably fairly young.
Okay, no, and I'm always excited when we talk about this stuff. If they're in a situation where we're just moving up into the 12-inch ball, that seems to be the timing that I find a lot of our players have issue. And often when we hear about this, we're taking very light bats into that 12-inch softball venue. You know, we talk about bats and the mass and the barrel and, you know, weight equals performance and things like that. And for some reason, especially for the younger, smaller kids, it just, the 12-inch ball overwhelms the mass of that smaller, lighter bat.
Right.
And it becomes a little bit of an issue. So that could be one piece of the puzzle. And, you know, it sounds like she's always making contact, not striking out and all those things. So the other piece of the puzzle is making sure that those first two strikes are an opportunity for her to shine and show her strongest, toughest, biggest swing, hitting through the ball and being willing to make some mistakes and maybe strike out sometimes in an effort to really generate a lot of power and get after it.
So. Well, I think you touched on a really important part of this discussion right there, Don, that so many kids, especially younger players, are so conditioned to think of a strikeout as a total failure that I think, you know, we start to see kids that are doing things, especially when they get two strikes, where they're just trying to make contact. They're just trying to just touch the ball. And you see
to not,
you
know, strike out.
Right. Almost looks like
not to get a hit, but to
like a glorified bunt almost. So like they're kind of just sticking the bat at the ball and hoping to make contact kind of thing. And so obviously if we're changing the swing drastically, trying to just make contact, there's a lot of opportunities in that to lose power and lose energy. The other thing that you said that I think sometimes, especially for younger players, is the bats that many of these kids are using are just way too light.
Right.
And I think that it's one of those traps that we've fallen into, you know, for the longest time, you know, and this is ancient history now, you couldn't get a fast pitch specific bat that was really balanced well and weighted well. And so that the idea of lighter was better just started gaining momentum to the point where you've started to see, you know, minus 12, minus 13, minus 14 bats, you know,
this was that bunt and punch. And,
yeah. So you'd have a bat that was 30 inches and 16 ounces. Well, the ball's 8 ounces. And if you got a 16-ounce bat, it's not all in the barrel. So you've got an 8-ounce ball and an 8-ounce barrel meeting each other in that collision. I'm not so sure that the barrel's going to win all the time with younger players because they're not swinging it that fast.
And for a period of time, the pitching dominated, so we had to have bat control and bat speed to try and catch up to that dominant pitching. But, you know, pushing them back and changing the ball and all those things. Yeah.
So Don, I think, you know, you mentioned a couple of things. So, Kelly, here's what I would tell you. First off is congratulate your daughter that she's putting the ball in play. Make sure that we're building on that. And then let's make sure that we're working on in her training and in her lessons and practices on just gaining confidence and trying to hit that ball aggressively, you know, making sure that she's thinking, trying to be as powerful and explosive as she can be. And sometimes we got to spend some time teaching kids what that feels like, what it looks like. We need to get away from some of the things that we've talked about in some recent discussions about demonizing the strikeout and making it, you know, feel like it's this, you know, the worst thing ever. And so that she starts to maybe swing with a little bit more authority and a little bit more aggressiveness and those kinds of things. And I think that there's a lot of different things at play that could be limiting her ability to drive the ball the way that she would really like to.
No, be excited for her to experiment with a little bit heavier bat. And and then, like you said, Tori, the mindset of, hey, I'm going to explode for at least my first two strikes.
Right. And I think a lot of that is how we're approaching it. If we're sending the right message, we can encourage her to be less cautious, because I think sometimes this discussion, to my way of thinking, revolves around players being too cautious, being too timid, being a little bit too careful in their approach instead of being aggressive and really thinking about what they can do to drive the ball. So Kelly, I hope that helps.
Yeah, need a couple good experiences and then she'll relax and cut loose there.
Yeah, and every once in a while it's like they have that aha moment where a kid doesn't even realize that they, you know, have done something extra special, and all of a sudden that ball jumps that first time, and you know it's like anything else. If they're as they start to have a little bit more success, they're going to like it, and they're going to start to want to do more of those things. So let's just make sure we're pushing the boundaries a little bit and stretching her limits a little bit. See if we can't help her get over the fear of striking out and let her allow herself to just let it rip once in a while.
Awesome.
All right, so that's going to bring us into this week's edition of Paige's Power Play.
Okay, so this is a fun topic today. I want to talk about private lessons are worthless without a competent mindset. And I'm really curious to see how you guys respond and what you guys think. And I want you guys to be honest. Of course, I see all sides and see perspective. But you're probably like thinking that I am just full of it because I'm a mindset mentor, right? Of course, I think that mindset and confidence is more important than the physical work, which I don't totally believe. So hear me out here, and I want you to see what I'm talking about. Okay. Because yes, the physical skills, the physical work is so important. The lessons, the practices, the trainings, all of it is so important. Like, no doubt about it. And if you girls were thinking, oh, yes, this was my opt out of practice, I don't have to work that hard anymore. Nope, that is not what I'm saying at all. Okay, so I'm sorry to burst your bubble, but the mental work is just as important and maybe even a little more important. On my side, I think it's more important, but it is just, they are equally important, or if not more important on the mental side, at least in my perspective. And here is why. When you go to that private lesson and your instructor, your coach is showing you how to do something new or like uncomfortable, like an uncomfortable adjustment, and for some reason you just can't make that adjustment for the life of you to save your life, your frustration starts to build and build, and then it spirals out of control, right? And then you're down on yourself, you might give up. You wonder if you're ever going to be able to do this. The doubt sets in, and sometimes even tears come, right? And you're at you're at the end of your lesson. You're on your way home. You're frustrated. You're angry. You're sad. You're upset. You're disappointed. You don't feel like you got better that day or in that lesson. And it almost kind of feels like a waste of time, right? This is where the mental work is crucial for your development as an athlete. When you're working on your mindset and your confidence and going to lessons and practices and training, this is where the magic lives. This is where like you put 1+1 and it like explodes. Okay. This is where the success comes. Because wouldn't it be amazing if you had tools and things to use, like to get past your challenges and your failures in order to grow and get better? What if you knew those? What if you were really good at those too? Instead of going into that like frustration spiral craziness, when you have the confidence, your lessons are going to be so much more productive. You're going to see so much more progress. And you're going to be so much more successful, and you're going to have so much more fun, and it's going to be so much more enjoyable because you're going through this with a different mindset, okay? The best athletes that I know are doing both of these things. They're practicing their physical side, and then they're also practicing the mental side, and like actually really putting in work on the mental side of the game, okay? They're working on their mindset, and they're going to their lessons and practices and training. They're taking action in both sides. So if you don't create more confidence, your lessons are going to continue to go the way that we talked about earlier. And know that if you're only doing the physical work, like you're missing out on a huge piece, and you're going to see so much more success if you do both of them. And I promise you, the mental work is not that hard. It's really pretty simple. You just have to take action and be consistent with it. Have an amazing day. Keep on keeping on.
All right, make sure you check out Paige's stuff, PaigeTons.com. She's a rock star. Love every week when she shares her message. I think it's always positive. It's always upbeat. And I think these are really important things for our kids to take away, to incorporate into their game. So Don, our leadoff topic is sponsored by Elite Sporting Goods. Elite is located at 905 Grayson Highway in Lawrenceville, Georgia. Phone number there is 678-377-0270. You can also contact them at elitesportsorders@yahoo.com. All your softball needs, bats, balls, gloves, equipment, uniforms, spirit wear, you let those folks at Elite help you out, they're going to get you hooked up. So Don did a blog post a little bit ago, Stan put it out on Facebook,
yeah,
about a discussion that I'd had with a friend of mine, a coaching friend, younger, a lot younger than me. But okay. Youngish, very, very successful, has had her team in the College World Series. And the point of the discussion was that in the short tenure of her coaching career, she said that when she first started, she would spend all her time at the ballpark watching a lot of players that were really passionate, that were really committed, that were really focused, and trying to sort through a big pool of passionate players to find the handful of really talented players that she wanted to recruit. And how she's frustrated because now in the last 8 to 10 years, she feels like it has switched. And now we have this gigantic pool of talented players but a lot of them are not very passionate. And so she's spending all her time now looking through really talented players, trying to find the four or five, trying to find the handful of kids that are really passionate and really care about the game. And I thought that was interesting because I think, you know, one of the things that, you and I both are fall victim to is the old man syndrome of, you know, like, you know, get off of my lawn, you know, back in the day kind of thing. So to hear somebody who's 30-ish sharing this message,
talking about that, yeah,
was really impactful to me. And so I thought it was very, very interesting. So I wanted us to talk about that a little bit because I think that what I'm also seeing, and this is something that's really troubling to me, is a lot of kids quitting. You know, some kids, when they get to college, they're quitting. I just had a 12-year-old player who I've worked with in the past, who's played on some really, really good teams, very talented, hardworking kid who just quit.
Right.
Doesn't want to play softball anymore. She just lost her passion for it, lost her drive to do it.
At 12, you?
At 12 and under.
Wow.
So, you know, now when somebody gets to be a 20-year-old college kid, if they're burnt out a little bit or a little bit, you know, over it, you know, I guess that's sad and disappointing because they've worked really hard to get to that point in their career. But it's even more heartbreaking to me to see somebody has lost that love of the game, lost the desire to play the game at such a young age. So back to the first question, the idea of, are players less passionate? Is it something that's really a problem? And of course, now when Stan posted the Facebook thing, had a handful of people that responded, well, not my daughter. My daughter loves this game. Not my daughter. My daughter's the one that, you know, she can't get enough of it.
Yeah.
And I think that that's true, that there are still some of those kids.
For sure.
If you spend time at the ballpark, like I do, kind of watching, you know, without having a dog in the fight in a lot of the cases, you know, not my team, not the kids that I'm coaching, not the kids that I'm working with, I see an awful lot of kids that just look like they're just, you know, dragging it in.
Wore out,
tired, don't want to be there, not interested in playing.
But rock star talent.
Yeah, but really, really talented.
Yeah.
So I think my coaching friend has hit on a point that's worth talking about. And you know, so it's not too long after that post went up, I saw something else on Facebook that was one of those memes that basically said, if you take your kids' games too seriously, they're going to hate playing. And so the idea of is, how is this all connected? And so is there a connection? Is there, you know, from a point A to point B to point C roadmap that we're on, that because we're pushing so hard, kids are getting so good, but because we're pushing so hard, kids are getting so sick of it?
Well, I think we've touched on this a number of times, Tori, too, in other episodes, but the whole concept where kids are pushed into specializing in one particular sport in the hopes that they will have a chance for after high school opportunities and things like that, I think are really key here. And, you know, as a parent, we're just trying to provide an opportunity for them to achieve some of those after high school goals, possibly, right? And even to get to play at a high school now is so competitive.
Yeah.
That if other people are doing it, they're going to sneak past us and they're going to get those opportunities and we won't. To find a balance or to find the sport that they can do often enough to achieve some of those other goals is, you know, really, I think, the magic. And to keep some balance and to keep things in perspective, like you say, if it's too important for, you know, the results to be too important and too much pressure and too much pressure too early in a athlete's career, then of course there's going to be a lot of drop off. But on the flip side, we're creating, just like your point at the very beginning with the college coach, is that we're creating a lot of really talented players to choose from and to pick from, and the game is being played at an accelerated rate and really high quality softball because they're getting this chance to play all the time.
Right.
And I think in the early years to us, which would be back, you know, in the 90s or even in the 80s and 90s, there just wasn't as much opportunity to overdo it.
Yeah.
Now it's really easy to overdo it. And the magic is in how much, how often, and what we do, what environment we get our kids in, and, you know, how soon personality-wise they're ready for that extra pressure to have to win every weekend. And you know, certain orgs or organizations are, we have to win to, you know, keep our name and to represent and all those things. And if it's that environment at too young an age, I think that's going to push some away at some point. Might be when they're, in your case, 12 for that right one, but when they're 16, 18, now we got to go off to college and represent again.
Right. Well, and I've dealt with this now a couple of times here this fall, and part of it, I think, is, you know, there's just been so much craziness going on this year that it's either making me more aware or it's maybe exaggerating or accelerating some of the challenges. But two really, really talented kids that I worked with that, you know, were as gung-ho and passionate about playing softball as any two human beings can be. Did the lessons, they did the travel ball, they did the high school, they did, you know, the strength and conditioning, they did everything that, you know, that a person can do with the goal of becoming the very best softball player they could, who as sophomores in college both decided that they've had enough, they don't want to play anymore. And to me, that's heartbreaking because, you know, they've invested so much and they're both such talented kids that the selfish part of me really wanted to see what that next step was going to look like and how good they could be at the college level. So that's the first example. But then when it, you know, trickles into 12-year-olds waking up and going, I don't want to do this anymore. It's not fun. I don't enjoy it. It's too much pressure. I mean, that's a whole nother thing. So I think you hit on a couple of really important things. Yeah, the players are so much better. There is so much more high-level talent. There's so many more highly skilled players now than once upon a time. It's shocking.
But still the same number of opportunities after high school.
Right. Yeah, I think
more there.
Yeah, well, I think the probably the numbers of opportunities since I started coaching have, let's say, even doubled. No, I probably doubled because when I first started, now remember, we're talking, when I first started coaching at Wisconsin Parkside, there was only like three schools in the Big Ten that had softball.
Yeah.
And there was like two schools in the SEC that had softball.
A long time ago.
Yeah, but
I'm kidding.
A long time ago. But when I first started coaching even in at Tennessee Tech in 99, you know, the SEC was just kind of getting started and you know, five or six of the SEC schools didn't even have softball. So we'll just say it's doubled, and just as an easy number to talk about. So we'll say the number of college opportunities since the year 2000 have doubled.
Okay.
Since the year 2000, the number of kids playing has gone up 100 times.
And the talent.
Yeah,
has...
it's exponential growth. And, you know, we've talked in the past about how you go all the way back to the 96 Olympics and the dream of playing softball in the Olympics made softball go from being a huge sport to a gigantic mega sport is, you know, the connection is obvious. But so now we've got, you know, hundreds of thousands of kids playing softball, and we've got a couple thousand spots at the table to play in college. We've got, you know, really very limited professional avenues after college. And so, you know, what can you do after you're done playing high school ball, travel ball, youth ball coming up is a pretty limited opportunity. But so we've got all these amazing players now trying to fight their way into that handful of spots. But I think that the reason that this is so challenging and why I'm not so sure what the answer is, it's kind of a catch-22. We have so many more kids that really are good at playing this game. But if I'm a college coach, if I don't have really good kids who really want to play,
right,
that's a nightmare.
That's hard to measure. I mean, you can body language and facial expressions and things like that, but that's tough to measure. You can figure out who can throw it, catch it, and hit and all that stuff.
Right.
But what's going on inside, you have to dig a little deeper and
right,
and do some investigative work.
And yeah. I think that was the point that that came from that initial discussion was, you know, here's a coach who is total go-getter, 24/7. Yep. Everything about her life revolves around helping her players be the very best they can, helping her team be the very best they can. You know, video study, the analysis, the, you know, statistical analysis. You know, watching film 24/7. You know, to break down every single kid's strengths and weaknesses, you know, a detailed, you know, to the second practice plan when she goes to practice every day with each player mapped out and filled in and, you know, targeted for what their strengths and weaknesses are. I mean, that kind of commitment to being successful for that coach, if she has a whole bunch of talented players who don't really want to work hard, that's a nightmare.
Sure.
And I think that's what she was talking about, that, you know, she has some players on her team that look at her passion for the game and her passion for the success she wants her program to have, and they're all in. They're bought in 100%. They can't wait to get to practice every day. And then she's got other players, some of whom are maybe even more talented, that it's kind of like, oh my gosh, I have to go to practice today. And I think part of why I wanted us to talk about this loss of passion idea and the number of kids quitting, and again, kind of comes back to the responses that we got from some of the people on the Facebook post. I would bet you everything I own that the dads that were so quick to say, not my daughter. My daughter loves this game. My daughter's never going to quit playing. She's the most passionate kid in America.
It's around the corner.
I would bet you everything I own that if 10 dads sent us that response,
right,
7 of their kids hate playing softball.
That might be true. I don't know. Yeah.
I'm going to, everything I own. And I'm not even going to be nervous. I'm not going to place that bet like I'm betting on the Super Bowl.
Not a betting guy,
yeah,
but
no,
yeah.
I mean, I'm not going to be the least bit nervous about it, because just because dad thinks his daughter is passionate doesn't mean that she really is.
Well, I think you're probably right on the money there, Tori. Again, I think that this is happening in all sports. This is for everything, because as you mentioned, the 12-year-old that is wanting to step away from softball, I've had some even younger than that kids that I had projected to just be off the charts, crazy, amazing softball players, because of what they were doing at such a young age, had chosen to step away from softball because it was so important for them to, one in particular, to play basketball, because they were so good at the basketball skills as well.
Yeah.
They felt like they had to specialize in basketball. So they stepped away so they wouldn't be distracted with this other game that they were really good at, because they didn't want to fall behind in another sport.
Right.
And if they didn't, project in that sport, then they might fall behind and not achieve some of their goals there.
Right. And kind of wrap this up, here's the first thing. Is I think that, you know, you've mentioned a couple of times the idea of falling behind. And I guess the real first thought I have to that idea is behind who and behind how. Because one of the, and here's why I think it's worth talking about. Of those kids that are so worried about falling behind, they're chasing after something that I don't care how hard they work, I don't care how much time they invest, they're not catching up. They're not getting where they...
You can't know that you're going to fall out of love with it or get bored with it until it happens.
Right. But I also think that the idea of everybody thinking that if player X is taking, you know, 20 hours of lessons a week and going to practice with, you know, 7 different coaches to work on every aspect of her game. She's got a hitting coach. She's got a pitching coach. She's got a bunting coach. She's got a strength coach. She's got a flexibility coach. She's got a nutrition coach.
Yeah.
That if player X is spending 20 hours a week working with all those people, that if somehow they don't figure out a way to spend 21 hours working, they have no chance of competing. I just think that we've talked ourselves into thinking this arms race idea of, if you do something, I have to do more. And if you do more than me, then I have to do more than you. And if you do more than I do, then I have to do more than that other person, is the reason why we're where we're at. I think that's why we're having this discussion.
I've heard the statement, if I'm not working hard at it, somebody else is, and they're going to get the opportunities that I wish I could have.
Right. So. And that can be true.
Right, I mean, it's catch-22.
Right, and again, here's why I want us to dig into this a little bit. What real opportunities are you losing out on?
Again, if our goal is to play in college.
Okay, so let's say pick a goal. I want to be the starting shortstop at Georgia, and I'm 12.
That's a good one.
Okay, I want to be the starting shortstop at Georgia. So what does that mean I have to do?
It depends.
Right. How much?
There has to be a lot. Well, if you don't try, then you'll never know.
But how much?
As much as you're able to put forth.
Right, but then that's where we get into this problem. So then you have that mom or dad or coach who thinks that 5 hours a week started off pretty good. Well, if 5 hours a week was good, 10 hours a week would be better.
So that's part of the magic, though, is knowing that threshold with your personality and your child and your opportunities.
How many of the people you know do you think really know that balance?
I don't, until you try.
You've been doing this for 20 years, right?
And we're going to have some fall off there. Right.
Okay, but so we'll just ballpark this. You've been doing this for 20 years. How many kids do you think started off with the goal of, I want to be the starting shortstop at Georgia or Alabama?
Most all of them, right?
Yeah, so 100. We'll just say 100 because it's a nice round number. Out of that 100, how many of it was it ever a realistic target?
A small handful.
5?
Sure.
Okay, so we're talking 5%, it's a realistic goal. How many of the parents thought it was a realistic goal? 100%?
Most of them.
98%?
But that's kind of like anything. If you've got a dream, you got to chase a dream.
But yeah, but whose dream?
You know, if that was my father's dream for me to do something, I think he might have had a little good influence on it.
Yeah. Well, but anyhow, so let's wrap this thing up because this can go on forever. Because here's what I'm going to tell you: what we're doing is marginally successful, but it's not as successful as it needs to be. We've got too many kids that don't really want to play softball that are out there every single day. We have way too many kids that are saying out of one side of their mouth that I want to be the starting shortstop at Georgia or I want to be the starting shortstop at Florida, that are at the same time hating going to practice, hating going to lessons, hating going to workouts. And so somewhere in there, there's a big problem, in my opinion.
Well, I think there's balance for sure. And I've seen number of times, Tori.
Time out, Don. So you keep saying we have to have balance, but you're also telling me that if I don't do more than everybody else, I'm going to fall behind. We can't have both.
No, I'm saying that's what their feeling is. I'm not saying that that's the proper approach. But the one thing for sure is if you don't try, you're not going to get it.
Right.
So if you don't put forth whatever effort you can and don't have a dream, then you're surely not going to accomplish it. So.
Right. No, and I agree with that. Dreaming is a beautiful thing. But dreaming to the point that I quit what I thought I wanted because all the fun and joy and excitement and positives of doing it has been dragged kicking and screaming out of me because I had to do all these things to follow my dream.
So my feeling on it, Tori, would be for all of us to continue to enjoy the game. When you're not enjoying the game, take a step back. If you do get some of these wild and crazy opportunities to play at a big school down the road, then that was meant to be. You know, otherwise, I think, to your point, if we push too hard, if we do too much, then even if we do make it to that point, we're not going to be excited about the end game or the end result.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And that's where the balance, right.
You know, and balance is the key. And you and I talk about this all the time. There's always a give and take. If I want to be the starting shortstop at Georgia or Florida, I've got to work really hard to get there.
Yeah.
There's no ifs, ands, or buts about it. I mean, even if I'm the most talented player, I still got to work really hard to get there. There's that's an absolute, you know, there's no discussing that. But I think what is the challenge for us now and the reason that this is so complicated is I think we have a lot of people chasing after those kinds of dreams that because they're chasing so hard, they're destroying all the other positives that should be coming from playing this game. And I think it'd be a lot better if more kids and more parents could look at it and say, okay, now that I know a little bit more, let's just come to grips with the fact I'm not going to be the shortstop at Florida or Georgia. But I could still really love playing this game and still be really successful and still play in college.
Sure.
And I'm not killing my opportunities to do that if I play basketball, if I take a two-week break to go skiing, if I decide to do something else once in a while to make sure I keep some balance in my life.
Absolutely. No, so. I'm all on board on that. And again, I want everybody to continue to enjoy the training, the games, the workouts on their own. And for moms and dads, if we've got downtime at home and they're out, you know, bouncing the ball off the wall, let's go take some fly balls and ground balls. But if they're, you know, distracted and wanting to go swimming and do some other things, then, you know, let's spend that time doing the other things too, right?
Right. Yeah. Well, and maybe sometimes I think for us as parents, if the kid's out there just having fun bouncing the ball off the wall,
maybe
we need to stand back and just watch them bounce the ball off the wall and cheer for them while they do it once in a while too. Because I think part of what we're talking about is that temptation that you just mentioned is, wow, she's really having fun doing this. Let's do this too. Let's do this other thing. And then all of a sudden, you know, instead of her just being able to bounce the ball off the wall for 5 minutes because she's having fun doing it, we made her pack up her stuff and drug her down to the park to hit her some fly balls.
Make the opportunities when she's excited.
Yeah. So, but anyhow, so hopefully that gives you some stuff to think about. But I just thought it was an interesting topic to hear to wrap up the year because I think, you know, for all of us as parents and coaches, you know, the idea of New Year's resolutions, I think one of the resolutions I would like all of us to make is to be a little bit more aware of the passion aspect of
level.
It, the how much passion our players have. And if they don't have a lot of passion for doing this game, that we try to figure ways out to give them the space they need so that when they come back to softball, when they do go to practice, when they do go to a lesson, they're really excited about being there instead of dragging it in like it's like they're doing somebody a favor. Don, that's going to lead us to our cleanup topic. Our cleanup topic was suggested by one of our listeners who's struggling with his team on figuring out how to cover bases on steals. And I think one of the things that we talk on all the time is how baseball and softball kind of are distant cousins of each other. There's a lot of things that are very applicable, but some things that are a little bit different because of the 60-foot bases and the idea of the way the game is played on the smaller diamond. I thought this was an interesting discussion to have because I think it's something that those of us that have been around the game for a long time kind of have some preconceived ideas, but maybe we're not always right.
No, I think it's exciting. You got to have a plan. You got to teach it, coach it, and be prepared for all situations, really.
Right.
You know, so.
And so I think, you know, the first thing I would always say is, you know, from my perspective, there's certain things that we're always going to take into account when we think about who should be covering in certain situations. And I think a lot of times it starts with the hitter that's at the plate and what kind of situation we think we're in relative to the big picture.
It all ties together.
Right.
Yeah.
So, you know, if there's a runner at first with nobody out, there's, you know, a lot of things that could happen with bunting and stealing that give us challenges that we need to make sure that we've got a coordinated plan that allows us to cover all the different options.
There's risk and reward.
Right.
Yeah.
You know, back in the day, in our baseball days, we would basically be in charge as middle infielders between the second baseman and the shortstop, kind of communicating between each other with who was going to cover. You know, we would do the old, you know, hide the sign in your glove of who's covering on each pitch thing to try to keep the defense from figuring out who was covering in each situation. But my background is really pretty simple. If we've got a runner at first, because we've got so many different bunt possibilities that we need the second baseman to be able to cover first, we almost always covered second with a shortstop.
Sure. No, that's just straight up most
right.
of the time, right?
But now here's the thing, and I think this might be part of where the challenge was coming from, because this coach had mentioned that his shortstop was having a difficult time getting to the bag. And so he had kind of just come to the conclusion that that meant he needed to switch and have his second baseman cover the base on steals. But here's where I think a lot of us get in trouble. Different philosophies, but here's my philosophy. If we know the runner is stealing, we have to play the steal. And what I think is happening with a lot of shortstops or a lot of second basemen as they're trying to cover is that they're waiting too long. They're waiting to see if the ball gets hit, and then trying to get to the base. And so what ends up happening is they're really late getting there and not in a position to handle the throw very often, and a lot of times not even close to getting to the bag by the time the ball gets there.
Well, there's other things you can do too, Tori, is, you know, in particular, try and pitch to the outside part of the plate on a right-handed batter who, you know, if a ball is struck well or hit well, that it should be to the right side of the
right.
second base. So
yeah.
Shortstop should be able to shade that way and protect for the steal. Nothing middling in for a right-handed batter to turn on to, you know, to show that we're vulnerable
right.
in that pocket. So that's one way to look at that,
right?
Right, or inside on a left-handed batter, so they're likely to pull the ball.
Yeah, no, I think that's a good point. But so for us covering second, we almost always use the shortstop just because, again, we wanted the second baseman to be in a position, but to make sure that that shortstop could get there in time, as soon as that runner is going, as soon as we know she's stealing, we are vacating our position to go and cover second base because we know for sure she's stealing. We don't know for sure that she could hit the ball to where I was standing at shortstop.
Right.
And, you know, common sense tells me that we can't be in two places at the same time. And if I wait until the ball's all the way to the catcher, I better be standing pretty close to second base if I'm planning on covering the base in time to receive the throw. So
absolutely.
So that was the first caveat I wanted to make sure that we threw in there, that in our defense, we're going to vacate our position to go and cover the bag. Does that expose us to the hit and run or the idea of somebody hitting the ball where we were? Of course it does, but Don, you touched on that. Well, if we pitch correctly,
easier,
limits the opportunity for that to happen.
Easier on an outside pitch for a catcher to throw the whole bit. Yeah.
But the flip side of it is every once in a while, you just got to shake the other kid's hand and say, hey, that's a nice job. If we vacate shortstop and you hit a ground ball where we were, you win. You won that one, okay? But then the second thing is who covers third base. So we've got different options there depending upon the situation. So now if we've got a runner at second with nobody out, one out, we still have to always be aware of bunt possibility. So then our whole defense has to be geared towards one or two options. Either my third baseman's going to be in a position to play the bunt.
Like a fake bunt steal.
Right, which means my shortstop has to be able to cover, or I have to have confidence in somebody else to be able to field the bunt.
On the third base side.
On the third base side, so that my third baseman can stay back and cover the bag. Now, either or can work.
If you've got a super athletic pitcher.
Right. But you know my philosophy. We've talked about this in the past. I want the third baseman to play the bunt, and I want the shortstop to cover.
Sure.
Okay. So if it is a fake bunt steal kind of thing, like you mentioned, you know, then the third baseman's got to respect the bunt. If she's showing me bunt, I have to think she's going to bunt.
It's a foot race.
Yeah. And so then my shortstop's got to be in a position to vacate her position and go and cover third base in time, cover the steal. And again, one of the things I think that makes these plays challenging is we have to spend enough time on it. We have spent enough time working on it that our infielders really get the concept of where they need to be and the time that they need to get there.
And it's practice.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because, you know, one of the things that I think is really challenging is sometimes that, you know, our third baseman, as she's working on where do I need to be to cover the base, is if they have not practiced it enough, they don't really know, okay, it's three steps, it's four steps, it's five steps, it's eight steps for me to get from here to the bag, and how long it takes for each of those things to happen. So the second thing, you know, the caveat is making sure that we're practicing it enough to have our kids have an understanding of the timing, you know, kind of playing the game like a shot clock in their head. So, okay, I'm going to cover second base as a shortstop, 3, 2, 1, there. Okay, and so, okay, that means it's going to take me that amount of time to get there. So when does that mean I need to leave from this position to get there in time to take the throw? If I'm covering third, same thing. When do I need to leave to get there to cover the throw?
I'd rather you be there half second too early than half second too late.
Absolutely.
Right?
So, and again, so each coach is going to have their own philosophy, but for me, it was always really simple. If somebody's running, we know they're running. We don't know that the hitter's going to hit it, and we don't know that the hitter's going to hit it where we were standing before. And so our objective is to always make sure that we're covering the base in time. We're leaving our position, if we have to cover a base in time, as you said, to be there a little bit early so you can adjust and make the play. The other thing that I think defensive players always get caught up in is that they think that they can do a lot of things at the same time. So you'll see that shortstop or second baseman or third baseman trying to wait till the last possible second because they think they can cover the bag, catch the throw, and make the tag all like instantaneously, all in one motion kind of thing. And unfortunately, I think that that's a trap that we fall into too. So I think that we need to be able to be there early enough, soon enough, that we've got time to adjust to a throw that's maybe not perfect.
Perfect, yeah.
And to be able to handle a throw that's maybe a little bit up the line or something like that.
And again, like you said, if they do a great job and we do what we're supposed to, sometimes that just doesn't go our way.
Right. But I think it's important that we lay down some basic guidelines, make sure that our kids are all on the same page, and then practice enough that those players all kind of have a feel for where they need to be, how much time it takes, so that the catcher and the player covering the base have sort of a connection, so they're on the same page with what's happening and how long it's going to take for it to happen.
Absolutely. And just have a plan, you know. I mean, again, we talked about having a situation where if we've got an athletic pitcher that can field that third base side, pitcher hits her spots all the time, you work the batter to the outside, maybe you can have your third base stay back for the throw.
Right.
If you feel like it's a real threat, you've got a chart on a batter and all they do is pull the ball all the time, you might want your shortstop to stay.
Right.
The ball gets past the pitcher, then third base has got to bail out on that throw if the ball gets bunted on that side and try and make an out.
Right. And then you also are going to have your adjustments when you face slappers, because slappers add a whole other layer to it.
A whole different layer, yeah.
Again, so who should be covering the base on the steals? It's going to depend on your philosophy, your strategy, but we need to practice it enough.
And they need to know.
And they need to know for sure so there's no miscommunication.
Yeah.
All right. So, Don, our coaching tip of the week, a quality at bat is not always a hit.
So true, huh?
And here's something, again, I want us to, you know, kind of New Year's resolution idea. We need to help our hitters understand that there's lots of things that they can contribute, lots of ways that they can help the team be successful, that they can have quality at bats. It doesn't necessarily mean that they're getting a base hit every time. Because I think especially for young players, that the idea that they made an out is the only thing that registers with them. It's the only thing that they can comprehend. And so they don't understand that they might be doing something that really helps the team, even though they didn't get a hit in that at bat.
The message that we tell ourselves is huge, too, and we might circle back on this. But if a batter goes up there, a hitter saying that I have to get a hit this time, they might be swinging at pitches because they've told themselves they have to get a hit that might otherwise provide them an opportunity to get a walk.
Right.
But if we're a tough batter that fouls a couple balls off and we've got two strikes on us, but then we're very disciplined enough to take a pitch that might be in the dirt, we advance a runner. We could foul two more off and battle a little bit longer, and then another ball in the dirt. Now we've got a runner at third base. Yep. So I've moved a runner over just because I've battled and had a strong at bat. And in the end, it might be that I get popped up, but you could even get a runner all the way around in one at bat.
Yep.
From first to home, through a good strong battle. So, but if I've told myself the message is that I've got to get a hit this time, I'm likely going to be swinging at pitches that otherwise might have provided me an opportunity to draw a walk.
Right. So some things that can be quality at bats that are not hits. So I advance a runner with nobody out.
Yeah.
Okay. So if there's a runner at second with nobody out, I hit a ground ball to the second baseman. I had a chance to get a hit, but I moved the runner to third, and
next person can
drive her in with a sacrifice fly.
Yep.
A walk can be a quality at bat. A hard hit ball is a quality at bat. An at bat where you force the pitcher to throw X number of pitches. Usually it's, every team has a different number in mind. But I think your point, Don, is a important one. Honestly, to my way of thinking, anything that makes the pitcher work extra is quality. Because, over the course of time, if we can make her throw an extra 10 pitches, 15 pitches, 20 pitches early in the game because we are scrappy and fighting for at bats and really digging in and battling, as you said, all of a sudden late in the game when she's up over that
threshold of pitches.
Yep. And now she's hanging a few more because she had to work that much harder earlier on. A sacrifice bunt is a quality at bat.
Yes.
So there's lots of things that a player can do that help the team at the plate besides getting a hit. But I think especially with younger players, they're so wrapped up in parents of younger players. What's the batting average? What's the on-base percentage? How many RBIs are they getting? How many, all those easily measurable things that don't necessarily always equate to being successful as a team. And so we want to start sending the message that, a quality at bat, something that contributes to the team's success, is a victory, no matter what it does to our batting average, no matter what it does to our personal statistics for the day or for the season, and that we need to start to value it. And from our coaching perspective, we have to really reward kids for having quality at bats. Something that we started doing when I was still coaching at Tennessee Tech is we had a chart, and after every at bat, there's like, we had like eight categories, and if any one of those eight categories was reached, then we knew for sure it was a quality at bat. And we kept the statistics, like a quality at bat average, to see how many kids were having quality at-bats. And one of the things that we noticed was that there was a gigantic difference between who had the best batting average and who had the best QAB.
Right.
And the QAB, quality at-bat, was something that when we started to break it down was much more contributing to success than just getting hits.
Productive.
Because, the moving the runner over, getting a runner in scoring position, a ground ball RBI, those kinds of things, a sac fly. All those kinds of things that are really, really important to team success that don't necessarily stack up as get you the conference player of the year award at the end of the year, but it might make your team win the conference championship.
Right. I like that.
Yeah. So coaches, we need to come up with a system, some sort of, whether it's a star on a piece of poster board or a sticker for their helmet or something that says that's a quality at bat, I think is a really good tool to send the message about how you value the quality at bat and how much your team should.
And just like you said, I love it, Tori, when you said to recognize it,
yep.
Whether it's in the post-game meeting or, just on the side.
Right.
Hey, that was fantastic the way you dug in and worked hard on those at-bats that maybe didn't provide the end result that you might have been looking for, but it really did help us.
Right, and if a kid hits a home run, we can't wait to have the
home plate meeting
and celebration, yeah, where everybody's patting them on the back. But I think if somebody has a 12 pitch at bat that leads to a line drive out, that helps us win a game later on in the day, that person needs to be patted on the back and celebrated just as much.
So for our hitters too, Torrey, the inside message of, hey, I'm going to have a great at bat, rather than I have to get a hit,
yep,
is a much better message for us, right?
Yeah, and much less intimidating, and much more likely to be something that we can be aiming for. So
nice.
So that's going to wrap up episode 144. We want to wish everybody a happy new year. Please, everybody be safe. Do everything you can to celebrate the end of 2020, because I'm confident that no matter what, 2021 is going to be better.
It's going to be a bit better for sure.
Yeah, it's going to be better. We want to make sure we thank all our sponsors, Cleated Up FP, Nexair, and Elite Sporting Goods. We want to definitely thank all of our patrons. We mentioned you all earlier today. It's very important you know that Coach Don and I really do appreciate your support. It means a lot to us, and we really do appreciate it. And then also, if you're in a position where you can help us, if you are not a patron, please go to patreon.com/everythingfastpitch. As always, please reach out to us at everythingfastpitch@gmail.com or fastpitchprep@gmail.com. And we'll make sure that we'll answer any questions you have and try to discuss anything that you are curious about. As you can tell from the content, quite often things that we talk about are suggestions that come to us from our listeners, and we always appreciate the input. And again, make sure you check out the fastpitchprep.com website and also our Facebook page. Tons and tons of information that's readily available to you. So, happy New Year. Enjoy your time with your family. For Coach Don McKinley and our producer, Stan Lewis, this is Coach Torrey in the Cherokee Batting Range podcast studio saying thanks for listening to episode number 144, and we'll talk to you in 2021.